Edgar Crooks. To my immediate is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahams, the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with the students today at noon, and anyone who would like to join us, you're all cordially invited. To my right is Justice William Babbitt, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosper. So with those introductions made, I will now call 01-1014 In re Elaine Hamilton versus Walter Hamilton, State v. Walter Hamilton, and appearing first representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Stephen J. Nix.
May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Steve Nix, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As the students in the audience may not recognize, that this is a real privilege for any attorney to appear before the Supreme Court, and many attorneys in their whole career don't get a chance to. When I was talking with the opposing counsel, Mr. Ramswell, before coming up here, we were discussing when and if we'd ever been here before, and it caused me to reflect that the last time I had been here, I didn't need reading glasses all the time, and I needed a comb. The case before you in this matter is seemingly a straightforward interpretation of the statute of limitations contained in section 893.40 of the statutes as related to the enforcement of child support judgments. At first blush, this section of the statutes is exceedingly short and clear. It provides that an action upon a judgment or decree of a court shall be commenced within 20 years after the judgment or decree is entered. The words seem to be excruciatingly clear. We know what judgment means, we know what 20 years means, and perhaps we know what enters means. The Court of Appeals, in dealing with this statute, found it to be unambiguous and applied the plain language rule, and as a result of interpreting that, the collection of certain past due child support owed by Mr. Hamilton in this matter was not collectible by the state. The Court of Appeals interpretation, however, is contrary to how we look at statutes of limitation in general, and contrary to the overriding history in the legislature and this court in interpreting child support enforcement, because it actually cuts off the collection of child support. And when we contrast this result, we come to the conclusion that the legislature could not have intended that Section 893.40.
Counsel, let me just ask you, because you recited the Court of Appeals opinion, which of course you're asking us to not follow. But it seems to me that by having the plain language, or I'm just asking you, the plain language, which we have a plain language rule, so you read statutes basically that they're plain on their face, and I don't think you're admitting or conceding, but you seem to say, yes, that's what it says, but then you say in your brief to interpret it this way would be basically absurd. But in this case, in all cases, with the plain reading of this, then everyone knows, both the state and the person that owes the arrearage, that this is what the statute says. I'm just asking, wouldn't it, when you know that the plain language, if we would interpret that way, wouldn't this simply force the state to get into these arrearage cases much earlier? Isn't that the problem that the argument is made, you know, why do you want to sit around and wait 15, 10 years because there have been so many changes? You could, you being the state, could have enforced this much sooner.
I think that what has to be distinguished is that there's a number of avenues for the enforcement of child support. What's before the court is an independent action for child support, which can be brought by individuals and not just the state. This is not an action.
No, okay, right.
And so there may be very valid reasons why the custodial ex-spouse does not bring this back to court. There's a big element of letting sleeping dogs lie, because my understanding of how human nature works, that if one brings in enforcement action or an action to collect support, that can provoke other very stringent or drastic actions on the other party's part to challenge custody or to have all kinds of other things going on, that there may be very good reason to wait until the children are 18 and then bring an action.
But is that something we should be saying, this will invoke this type of reaction? Is that a valid consideration for this?
I think it is a consideration, Your Honor, not the consideration. The interesting part of the Court of Appeals reading of 89340. First, everyone has to understand that 89340 applies to all judgments, not just child support judgments. And as I tried to illustrate in my brief, the child support judgments are significantly different from all other kinds of judgments that 89340 would apply to. 89340 judgments in general, outside of child support, are final upon entry. Child support judgments are not final until the court loses jurisdiction under 767.32, and that is not until the last or the youngest child is 18 or 19 if that child is still in high school.
So why should we apply the statute at all?
Well,
and say that because it obviously presupposes the sort of judgment which fixes liability at a certain level at the time of entry of the judgment, it doesn't apply in the default statute of limitations.
Meaning what? I don't understand your question.
89340 speaks in the language of a statute of repose.
Correct.
20 years from the date of entry or you're out. It doesn't reference back to the date of a cause of action accruing, etc.
That's correct.
And it seems by its language to presuppose the garden variety sort of judgment, which fixes liability at a certain amount at the time of entry of the judgment. And that's not the kind of judgment that a child support order is. A child support order, as we've just articulated, may be modified at any time during the course of the child's minority, and the liability for non-payment does not become fixed until the expiration of the order, which occurs at the time that the child reaches the age of majority. So why wouldn't we just say 89340 doesn't even apply, because that's not the kind of judgment we've got here, and apply the default statute of limitations instead?
And I think that's an option open to the court, and I think that was argued before the Court of Appeals, and that is one avenue of resolving this dilemma, which it would seem to be very inconsistent with the legislative intent. And the idea of some old statutory interpretation is to give breadth and meaning to the legislative intent, and the legislative intent overwhelmingly has been in this area, is the collection of past due child support and not the excusal of payment. So one option, the option you suggest to interpret this, is a way to go, and was argued before the Court of Appeals that this is not the kind of judgment. The other way to go would be, for example, to interpret entry of judgment more liberally, that entry does not have to be the language, the statutory definition in Chapter 806, that entry could mean when the court loses its, the trial court loses its jurisdiction to revise the judgment. So I think either avenue from an interpretation standpoint is a way to both give breadth to the collection of child support, and also, and I'd be remiss to say it, that a very important point here is how the Court of Appeals interpreted the statute of limitations is completely out of step with how normal statutes of limitations attach. Here we have the attachment of the statute of limitation. The clock is running upon judgment when, in effect, there is nothing to come to court about. No payments have been missed yet. And so you have the anomalies of someone, for example, getting divorced when the child was 1 year old and making payments for the first 15 years and then missing payments from year 15 on. Well, the statute of limitations has already run for 15 years, yet nothing has been owing, and that person, the spouse to whom this money is going to be paid eventually, could not have come to court because there's nothing is ripe at that point. So your question is absolutely correct that this judgment, this kind of judgment, is so out of step with the normal judgments of 89340 that the legislature was clearly referring to, that the legislature could not have intended this kind of a result, and therefore interpretation of words that seem clear are necessary.
Mr. Nix, if you didn't rely on 89340, would you be able to rely on a 20-year statute of limitations?
I think that it would relate back. The default statute would be 89304, which says that for judgments for which no other statute of limitations is applicable, it's a 20-year statute of limitations from the date of the accrual of the accrual of the cause of action, and therefore you would go back to the rule that was in effect up until this case it was a 20-year statute of limitations applied after the youngest child reached majority or 19 if the child was still in high school.
What about 89387, general limitation of action in favor of the state, which is a 10-year limitations period, which contains similar language if no other statute of limitation applies, and that, it's in favor of the state, it's 10 years.
The judgments of divorce, other than the peculiarity that the state is bringing this standing in the shoes of the ex-spouse, the state doesn't have to bring these independent actions. These can be brought by the private individual, by the ex-spouse. The reason that the state is involved is that there was an assignment of the benefits due to an AFDC payment. So I don't think that that's the correct avenue to do, because it wouldn't apply to all actions. It would only apply to those brought by the state. And I think the default is much better in the 89304.
I have but two questions. One, many judgments are not, may not be final. For example, you can open up a judgment sometimes within a year, sometimes beyond the year. So this is just part of not being final. I agree it may be less final than others, but all judgments may have the attribute that as of the date they entered does not mean that they are valid and effective. For example, there might be an appeal, but maybe the judgment will still start as of the date of the entry. That's number one. Number two, can you modify a judgment of support so that you wipe out the arrears, or do you modify a judgment of support only for future support?
Only for future support. The statute has been changed to limit the court's discretion. You cannot wipe it out.
So, in effect, it is a running judgment, and at least as to the amounts as of today that are passed, judgment can't be changed.
That's correct.
And so it's a final judgment as to that arrearage. It can only be modified in the future. All right. My third question is this. You only appealed, as I reread your petition for review, the issue as to post-1980, because you won on the issue of pre-1980.
Yes.
You didn't have to appeal. In fact, that would not have been a valid appeal as to that part of the decision of the court.
Yes.
So that's why you're not talking about your pre-1980.
Yes.
And as I read Mr. Ramsdale's response, he did not cross appeal or seek a cross review here.
That's correct.
Just checking.
I appreciate your attention to the briefing, Your Honor.
Counsel, much of the discussion thus far has been using the word judgment, and indeed you state the issue in your brief as follows. Does the limitation period in 89340 for actions on child support judgments begin to run in all instances at the date of entry of judgment, as that term is defined in the statutes? As a circuit court judge, I would have a vast number of child support arrearage cases before me that never were made a part of a judgment. For instance, in judgments of paternity, most often I would enter a judgment of paternity and child support would not be included at all in the judgment of paternity, and it would be months, oftentimes, unfortunately, years before a judgment of support might be entered. It would have a group of people coming in every Tuesday on child support morning and going through all of these orders, not one of them being part of any judgment. So, question one, why do you define the issue with regard to child support judgments? Are you leaving out this vast number of kids who aren't subject to any judgment?
I hope not. I didn't leave them out intentionally, Your Honor. I was trying to focus on the situation we had here. In my preparation for the argument, I talked to people who like yourself, have had a great deal of experience, and one of the charming phrases that I've learned is that there's a lot of silt in the water in this area in terms of the bright lines and in terms of when certain things apply. And I think that coming up with a bright line solution to this in terms of having it pegged to things that are understandable by common people. One of the other things that I think you're very aware of and that I wasn't was the vast number of people who are unrepresented in divorces and certainly maybe overwhelmingly unrepresented in paternities, that the kind of system that is in place in this case by the Court of Appeals rewards sort of the people who have lawyers, the people who can come back to court and get a restart, if you will, because the facts in this case, there was an amended judgment in 1977 and there was a restart of the clock. Well, the people who are less sophisticated or who are less able to afford lawyers aren't going to get that restart.
So let's take a look at the statute, because I see the statute as referring, and I'm talking about 89340, as upon a judgment or decree. Now, a child support order is not a judgment or decree. How does this statute apply to those children who are not part of a divorce judgment?
I think where that may come in is in 767.30. It speaks about the concept of orders being enforced as if they were final judgments.
Yes, I know, and I'm familiar with that language, but all that phrase in and of itself almost underscores my point, as if they were judgments, so an order is not a judgment.
I think that's a fair reading, and that section, that language in that section, troubles me with respect to the question you're posing. I don't know what that answer is with respect to those kinds of judgments or orders that just happen, whether they be enforcement orders or setting down at that point where the statute of limitations kicks in for those.
When does the statute of limitations, under your argument, begin to run?
When the circuit court loses revision jurisdiction under 76732.
How does that comport with the language you just referred to, or other language in 76730, which indicates, I think under 3C, which indicates you can come in, unlike in the Halmu case, unlike in the Krieger case, unlike in the Douglas County case, you can come in at any time there is a missed payment. And conceivably, not practically, but legally, you can get a money judgment for every month that someone missed child support. You no longer have to wait until the child has reached the age of maturity. How does your response comport with that statute?
Well, I think they can exist together quite easily, Your Honor, that's sort of the restart of the clock type of concept that truly favors the more sophisticated and the people who are for other they can exist together.
I'm not understanding that. It seems to me your position is that it is when the child reaches the age of majority, or 19, etc. How can you have it both ways? Is it the people who are sophisticated enough to come in when the child is 10 and the parent isn't paying to get a money judgment? Their time is going to start running differently? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's certainly what the Court of Appeals has suggested.
I know, but I'm asking what you're suggesting.
I don't think that would give the bright line that would be appropriate. I think that if we have statutes of limitations for each missed payment, for example, the enforcement morass and the impact on the courts from a standpoint of efficiency would not be heeded. I would think that the preferable approach, if these cannot exist, and I'm not convinced that they can't exist together, if they cannot exist together, it seems to me having a bright line rule that applies after the circuit court loses jurisdiction upon the child being 18 or 19 and 20 years post works better from a court administration standpoint and works better from a fairness standpoint to all litigants, not just the sophisticated litigants.
Mr. Nix, if I were still a legislator, I think your arguments would persuade me to vote with you. I'm having a real difficulty, however, taking the text of 89340 and then transforming that text into the rule that you seek. Can you make the linkage for me how to do that?
Well, the linkage is either of two directions. The linkage, I suggest, is that the interpretation by the Court of Appeals of entry does not have to be upon filing in the clerk's office, that entry can be interpreted as when the court loses jurisdiction. Entry can be equated with finality, and I think that's a better way to look at entry. Or we could look at the word judgment, which Justice Sykes has talked about, that this just is not the kind of judgment that the legislature wanted to come within the purview of 89340, and therefore you go to the default, which is 89304. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nix. Mr. Ramsdell, representing Walter Hamilton.
Good morning. I am Attorney Bob Ramsdell. I'm a solo practitioner in Madison, and I do represent Walter Hamilton. I would like to introduce Walter to you. Walter, would you please stand? This is Walter Hamilton. I suggested Walter may want to drive up from Kansas to observe today's proceedings, to get a sense for what all the fuss is about. I think it's his case, and I suggested he may want to be here, and he did drive up. To join with Mr. Nix, I've been practicing law for a little over 28 years, and this is my first time in front of this body, and I'm privileged to be here. I can tell you it was my choice to not be here. I wish this case were over, but we are here, and I'll do the best that I can to explain Walter's position. It's important to remember I represent Walter Hamilton. I don't represent the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin or anybody else, and I have to address myself to the facts of this case as they address Walter Hamilton. I'm one of those slow learners sometimes, I'm afraid, and I was telling someone in the gallery before we started, the bright light went on for me. I hope it was a bright light, about 5 o'clock this morning when I was laying in bed. I think the state's basic argument is fundamentally flawed. It's fundamentally flawed, and it's flawed in this regard. I think Justice Sykes is right. This is a statute of repose. It certainly fits the definition of a statute of repose. And I had cited a case in my brief to the Court of Appeals. It is from this court. It's Castellani versus Bailey, and I'll read the footnote from the statutes. The discovery rule applies to statutes of limitations that limit the time to sow from the time when the action accrues, being a time of discovery. The discovery rule does not apply to a statute of repose, a statute that specifies the time of accrual and limits the time suit can be brought from that specified date. And I think that's where the state is absolutely just missing the boat. This is a statute of repose, and what happened in this case, because this case, the law changed. And I think if the state were to say, what is your position on a divorce that's filed after July 1st of 1980? Judgments entered after July 1st of 1980. And the children were all born after the change of the law. I think the state would say that the old rules of 893.14 and 893.16, as interpreted by Helmu, still apply. Because as I understand their arguments from the very beginning, that's what they think this court ought to do, is to basically say, we're going to continue to use the rules that existed prior to July 1st of 1980. That's where Judge Nickel made his error when he wrote his decision denying Walter's motion to dismiss. Because what he did is he engrafted Helmu and the cases after that onto 893.40, and Helmu is a discovery case. It's an accrual case. So I think in that respect, Judge Nickel, that was his fundamental error. And unfortunately, I really didn't see it as articulately as this until this morning.
But the legislative history, such as it is with regard to 893.40, suggests there's no leap from a statute of limitation to a statute of repose that's intended. Maybe the words accomplish that, but none was intended. It was intended to repeal and recreate its predecessor statute, as I understand the history, and to address the issue of foreign judgments having a 10-year statute of limitations. Is that your understanding of the history?
That's my understanding of the limited part of the history, but the language of the statute seems to fit exactly a statute of repose. That's what I think they created. I can't tell you whether they intended to create a statute of repose, but that indeed is what they did. They did indeed create that creature.
So what should this court do if there's nothing in the legislative history that would indicate changing the statute from its predecessor to the current one? The predecessor clearly was a statute of limitations. Is that correct?
I agree.
And the cases that have been cited to us, the Helmuth case, the Krieger case, the Douglas County case, the Fisher case, all treat this as a statute of limitations issue.
Well, that's because all of those cases, the cause of action accrued under the Helmuth rule in Kroger and in Douglas County prior to the change of the law. The youngest child reached a majority in the Douglas County case in 1977. And Megan Krieger reached her, I think it's Kroger, reached her age of majority prior to the change of the law. That's the problem. All those cases predate this change. That's why they're, in my view, they're really of no help to us anymore. So what I think we have here, the rules of the game changed on July 1st of 1980, and the state is charged with the responsibility more than anyone of collecting these old arrears, especially when we used to have the AFDC rules and all those assignments. So the state didn't change how they thought about these cases. They didn't change their game plan to go along with the change of the rules, and that's, I think, why we're here today.
Would the legislature change the statute from being a statute of limitations to a statute of repose, thereby having the potential to greatly limit the potential to get child support arrearages collected? Why would the state do that without mentioning any of that in its history?
I can't answer that because I can't speak for the legislature why they would have done something. But what I can say is I cannot envision, and I don't think anybody that's briefed on behalf of the other side can envision, an instance where the statute of limitation, the statute of repose in this case, would expire prior to arrears being collectible. And in fact, now under the rules we have, there are numbers of devices, liens on real estate, wage assignments, attachment, garnishment, money judgments. The legislature's continually provided for enforcement rules. The question is, how long can you go out and enforce these rules?
Let me just take a hypothetical, and it's in a bit of an extreme, but perhaps to make the point. The law is, as I understand it, that the child support obligation continues until age 18, the age of majority, or until 19, as long as the child is in regular attendance at the secondary school.
Or a GED program or something.
Program. Yeah. Thank you. So here you have a child who's in regular attendance at a GED program, and finishes the program a week before his, still 19,
right.
And still a week before his 20th birthday, and has not 20th birthday. Is the statute not yet?
It stops at 19.
At 19, okay.
Yeah.
Finishes the program a week before 19th birthday. Mm-hmm. Then in essence you're saying that the party has a year.
Assuming the judgment was entered on the child's birthday. Which, that's really not feasible.
Well, 2 years.
Two years. So
you'd
have 2 years.
Of a one-year
I would point out in Griffin versus Reeve, when I read that case yesterday, what I noted was mom was the payee. She was in court 2 months after her youngest child reached the age of 18. Now, mistakenly using the old accrual rules of the age of majority, but that's my point in this case. There has been such an extreme lack of diligence in this particular case. And the statutes we are left with and the statutes I've had to focus on are the 20-year statutes because that's what they used before and that's what the state has argued all along. In Walter's particular case, what we have is we have a bridging of the change of the law. And that kind of complicates Walter's case. And I like to address myself a little bit to that. The judgment, we know, was entered in Grant County on June 22nd, 1970. The only order amending the judgment as to child support, the only order amending the judgment, was entered in Dane County after the case had been transferred up here when Elaine moved, and that was entered on November the 9th, 1977. And the state cited the statutes 990.06 and 990.107, and I admit that the language of those statutes sort of made my eyes glaze over. I looked at them a couple times, and I really didn't get a good feeling for what those statutes meant, but the appellate court helped me in that regard when it said, simply put, when a statute of limitations is replaced or amended, a cause of action that is accrued prior to the effective date of the new statute or amendment is governed by the prior statute, unless the legislature specifies otherwise, which it did not in this case. Conversely, a cause of action that is not yet accrued prior to the effective date of the new statute or amendment is governed by the new language, unless otherwise specified. What we have here is, under the old rules, the cause of action accrued when the child reached the age of majority. That date was April 4th, 1985. The cause of action, therefore, under the old law, never accrued. Because it never accrued, then the new law would apply, and it would relate back to, and when does it, what does it relate back to? If for simplicity's sake, you would relate it back to June the 22nd, 1970. Because for simplicity's sake, that's your bright line.
I'm sorry, could you go back with that argument?
Sure.
You said the cause of action never accrued under the old law?
No.
I'm not following.
The old statute of limitations, as interpreted by Helmu, said that the cause of action accrues for the purpose of commencing an action to enforce the judgment, to get a money judgment, an independent action, accrues when the child reaches the age of majority, and then the final calculations can be done. Now, interestingly enough, of course, Helmu goes way back to
19... When did the judgment accrue, in your opinion?
In Walter's case?
Yes.
It would have accrued under the old laws on April 4th, 1985. But it did not, because the law changed, and now the new law would apply, and then I think the entry of the judgment language means that we relate it back. And for Walter's case, it doesn't matter whether you relate back to the entry of the original judgment or the entry of the amended judgment, because both of those 20-year time periods expired before the state commenced the action that brings us before you today.
I'm sorry, the cause of action accrued at the time the child reached 18, which occurred sometime in April of 1985?
No, not in this case, because the law changed. The law changed on July 1st of 1980.
But the statutes say that the prior law applies, so as to any arrearages, as of April of 1985, those accrued when the youngest child reached age of majority, and those are due and owing, and the cause of action was filed within the 20 years after that date.
No, I don't think that's the reading of the law. The law had changed. Therefore, if a cause of action has not accrued at the time of the change of the new law applies. And the new law says that the time limits begin to run from the time the judgment is entered, the time the judgment is filed with the clerk of courts. And that's either June 22nd of 1970 or November 9th of 1977. Because the statute changed before the cause of action accrued under the old law. So that the cause of action never accrued under 893, 14, and 16 and Helmu, because 893, 14, and 16 were repealed effective July 1st, 1980. They no longer existed. And those cases that interpret that statute, how can they continue to exist? Unless you graft them into 893-40 if you want a 20-year statute. But the problem with that is, then you take a statute, what I think is a statute of repose, and create a statute of limitations. And you've said in your own case that that is not permissible. So what I'm left with the proposition is the state's claim against Walter to commence an action on the judgment, to enforce the judgment, to do income income assignments, income tax intercepts, whatever, ended one of two dates. It either ended on June 22nd, 1990, or it ended on November the 9th, 1997. I would also point out that if you're talking about fairness, the loss of a right, even if they waited till the cause of action accrued under the old law, which Judge Nickel found to be April 4th, 1985, even if they waited, the state, as the assignee of Elaine, had from then until, at a very minimum, June 22nd, 1990, they had over 5 years to do something. And if you decide that, no, that clock starts ticking every time there's an amendment to the judgment that's filed, then they had 13 and a half years, and they didn't do anything. Walter's a poor man. Walter is not a rich man. He's old. I mean, he's 61 years old. He wants to retire one day, and all, he has no retirement plan. He has nothing. That's the problem with waiting and waiting and waiting, ticking the files up for 15 years. We had originally brought kind of a scattergun approach to our motions. We had also claimed latches. Then I read Patterson, and Patterson seemed to say latches is not available. And I read Wall yesterday, and it seems to say latches might be available because it might be available once a statute of limitations starts to run. Of course, we don't have really a statute of limitations. We have a statute of limitation, which is a statute of repose. So the question on relation back, also, the Court of Appeals did change the rules on accrual. And because this is application of law to a set of facts, it's a de novo review, I'll suggest that because the cause of action under the old law in this case never accrued, that perhaps the Court of Appeals should not have changed the rules about when these arrears accrue as a cause of action. What they said is that all of the arrears that had, for any missed payments that had not been made, were accrued under really a change of the rule, their fundamental rule, on June 30th of 1980. The question becomes, well, is that the right way to do it? If you've got a cause of action that had never accrued under the old rules, do you then change the rules and say, now we're going to change the date, we're going to fix a bright line based on the change of the law and say that they had accrued? And the Court of Appeals says, a matter of fairness and a matter of a vested right that Elaine would have had in these missed payments. And then I look at the fact they had, Elaine would have had 5.5 years, or her assignee would have had a minimum of 5.5 years to 13.5 years. And is that result fundamentally unjust? Was there adequate time? I personally think, because when I read the Kroger case and I see that Megan, who's an adult child in her 30s, suing her father, I mean, that is a very painful thing to think about, that a child or anybody would want to sue a parent, but to let a case like that linger and linger and linger and linger, and here you got a child 37 years old as an assignee of a parent, or 38 years old, filing actions and litigating against their father. That to me is bad public policy, and to me that is absurd. But I don't think anything the state has really said in its briefs or in its argument today suggests to me that anything that Walter is proposing to you is absurd in any way. It's in compliance with the plain language of the statute.
But could I ask you how you would interpret 893.40 if the statute was limited to 10 years instead of 20 years?
I don't know that I would change my I mean, 893, I don't know that I would change my view of that statute at all if it was 10 instead of 20 years. For purposes of this case. I don't think.
As I understand it, the action accrues at the time of the original judgment. The court order or judgment.
Correct.
All right. And if someone doesn't non-comply immediately, let's suppose the non-compliance didn't come until the 12th year after that judgment. Wouldn't the statute of limitations have run then?
Sure. It would have. If that were the case, then that statute would not be the applicable one to a case like this, it seems to me. The legislature didn't provide us with anything different. And that would not make sense, and that would be absurd, because I know you do need to be able to enforce it, but then maybe you go in and enforce and you get a whole new judgment.
Very troublesome to
me. That's really troublesome, yeah.
It's very troublesome to me that your interpretation of the statute says that the statute starts running at the time of the judgment, even though there may have been no non-compliance with the judgment for years.
But in the case before us, there is no time that I can envision when you would not have remedies post loss of jurisdiction in terms of revision jurisdiction for revising the amount of child support. I would point out Judge Nickel revised how the child support is paid. The troublesome one for me, and I haven't gotten a good answer for, is what about an unlimited maintenance award? That troubles me. But, because that could go beyond a 20-year. I can envision no case when a child support one could go, and that's what we're here on. But it seems to me this is something the legislature ought to really deal with. You know, I'm just a solo practitioner. I can't think of all the nuances and subtleties and come up with clear and crisp and wonderful answers. But it seems to me that what I'm here to try to do is to relieve Walter of this old burden so he can go on about the rest of his life. But the question is, should the legislature address this if indeed, as the state points out, these judgments are different? That's really up to them to do it. Have their hearings, listen to a lot of people, and come up with a conclusion, probably put it right in Chapter 67, where we can find it, that makes some sense under all the permutations and combinations that we have.
How would you define the issue or issues in this case?
The issues in this case, as I would define them, are which statute of limitations applies, and I think it's 893.40, and how do you transition a judgment entered prior to 893.40 and arrears that accrued prior to then, and how do you transition into this new statute? How do you apply this new statute? It's not even a new statute. It's been with us for 22 years. And that seems to be it in a nutshell. But for me, the issue is it appropriate for the state to collect this money from Walter Hamilton after all these years? That, to me, is my issue. And I don't think it should be allowed to do that.
Well, your position, I mean, this is probably a very unfair question, but if Walter were to go and buy a lottery ticket, I don't know if they have a lottery in Kansas, and won $1 million, your position would be he owes nothing. They can't reach him.
That's right. That would be my position.
This case isn't just about Walter.
And if Walter were somebody else, a totally unsympathetic person who was professional, made a lot of money, and just refused, my answer would be the same. Look, if a young fellow takes a beer glass and slams it into the face of somebody else out in the parking lot at the Farm Tavern here in Dane County. You got 2 years to commence your action to claim, and this is a bad guy. This is a violent alcoholic, very unsympathetic defendant. But if you miss your two-year filing, doesn't matter how bad a person he is, he's out. Doesn't matter what those circumstances are. If you miss the statute of limitations, you're finished. And that's what happened in this case. The time within which the state could do anything to collect this money from Walter expired. And it matters not to Walter if it expired in 1990 or expired in 1997. It was finished. It was gone. For his purposes, it was completed. They waited too long.
You indicate the issue is what statute of limitations applies. That is, I assume, 89340, or you're talking about 8...
I talked about 89387. And I talked about that statute because I was trying to be helpful, actually, because the state was very insistent upon the accrual of a cause of action. And as I've pondered and reviewed these statutes, I said accrual isn't appropriate under the new statutory scheme. So I said, well, here's a statute that says if it's in favor of the state and if no other statute applies, and the appellate court rejected my argument pretty much out of hand. But here's a 10-year statute with accrual language if that's what you want.
So
it's on the books.
So you're talking about the 89387 being the 10-year for causes of action brought by the state? Is that what you're referring to?
In favor of the state, yes.
But so many of these are brought by individual parties,
sure,
and not by the state.
Sure.
So is there a different cause of action? Is there a different limitation for those that are not brought by the state then?
The only one that I'm aware of is 89340. That's the only one that I'm aware of, and that's
what about 89304?
You know, I've got 89304 here, and I don't see any number in there. My version of it says, unless otherwise specifically prescribed by law, a period of limitation within which an action may be commenced is computed from the time that the cause of action accrues until the action is commenced. And it seems to me that it was exactly that statute, because the note to Castellani versus Bailey that talks about, that I read earlier, the discovery rule applies to statute of limitations that limit the time to sue from the time when the cause of action accrues, and the discovery rule does not apply to a statute of repose. Well, that which means you'd only graft that language into 89340.
Well, if 89304 apply,
what's the
then does 89340 apply?
Where do you get the 20 years on 89304 is where I'm confused. This is an issue I've not thought of prior to now. So I don't know where the 20 years comes from 89304. I don't see a particular time limit in here. If you say the default is 20 years, then that might be. I don't have an answer for that. Well, my warning light's on anyway, so.
You have several more minutes until the red light goes on.
I'm trying to think if I have really anything more to offer you folks this morning on these questions.
Are there any further questions?
Does the fact that the court has ongoing jurisdiction to modify a support award play any role in this analysis at all?
No. No, because except to the extent the court actually modifies, then you could make the choice that the clock starts to tick again. The 20-year clock starts to run again from the time of the entry of the judgment amending the support order. That's a choice you can certainly make. And it might preserve for the state a number of their cases that otherwise might have expired. But I said in Walter's case, it matters not to him, because if you make that choice, the time is still expired. So it's really up to you. And it's the state's concern about complexity and confusion, especially to litigants that are unrepresented. But it seems to me that it's certainly something that even trial judges might want to explain to the pro se litigants about what their time limits are. But 20 years from the time a judgment is amended would be a pretty ample period of time to enforce your remedies under the law. But if you wait, as anybody who waits, your cause of action expires.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsdell. Mr. Nix?
This court, in interpreting statutes, has reiterated that the purpose of statutory interpretation is to discern the intent of the legislature. And I get that from, it's been repeated a great many times, that's from Reyes versus Greatway Insurance, 227 West 2nd, 357. One of the other more interesting things that Reyes talks about is that a statute can be unambiguous in one setting and ambiguous in another. And certainly 89340 is that kind of statute. For the vast number of judgments that are not amendable other than the one-year period for very limited grounds, entry of judgment means finality. Whereas divorce judgments, child support judgments, paternity judgments, finality depends on not only the actions of the parties post the judgment, whether they're going to pay or not pay, but also upon whether the court changes things.
Counsel, you have two approaches, as I understand it. One deals with this entry of judgment. The other deals with this statute of repose sort of issue. Am I right or am I wrong? You're talking about earlier in response to Justice Sykes' question you could change the literal meaning of 89340 by attacking it with regard to the entry of judgment. I think you also indicated or look at the word judgment, then go to the default of 89304. Those
Correct.
Are the two ways you are going to do it. Number one way, entry of judgment. One of the things that causes me concern is we start fooling around with words like entry of judgment. We've got ramifications that might be unknown to me. Entry of judgment in all sorts of contexts. And so I don't like playing around with definitions that seem to be rather solid in the law. I'm not sure they are, but that arguably. And so I'm intrigued by this 89304, but your opposing counsel raises the question, well, where do you get 20 years by 89304?
I think that can be accomplished by reading it in conjunction with 89340, using Justice Sykes' suggestion that looking at judgment, that this kind of judgment is not the kind of judgment that the legislature intended to be within 89340, and reading 04 and 40 together, you get the cause of action accrual of 04 with the umbrella of .40 to get the 20 years.
Couldn't the legislature simply have said that then? That would be, I mean...
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I think that refers to Justice Bradley's issue or question as to when we, if we deal with it and say, well, this is different.
Absolutely. They could have expressed their intent much more clearly, but the goal is to look at how anyone could say that the legislature intended to cut off the collection of child support when it enacted 89340. When
viewed in the panoply of other things the legislature has done, ranging from the 1977 Divorce Reform Act, which recognized the pervasive problem of the collection of child support, to all the other actions since 1980, the tax, income tax intercept, the wage assignment continuation, this court's ruling in Griffin in 1987, continuing the contempt collections beyond the child's 18th or 19th birthday. This kind of interpretation that the legislature would have intended to cut off the collection of child support. In effect, what this interpretation did was relieve Mr. Hamilton of paying whatever payments he missed from 1980 to 1985. I don't think anyone can say that that would be the intent of the legislature when it passed a general statute of limitations viewed in the constellation of everything it did before and after with respect to this pervasive problem of collection.
Counsel, your interpretation of the statute applies whether the judgment was entered before or after 1980.
Well, this would apply to only judgments that were entered after. I agree with the Court of Appeals that there is a vesting aspect since the missing payments, that cause of action comes with each missing payment. And the Court of Appeals analysis is that there is a vesting prior of the old law with respect to payments missed before the enacted date of the new law.
Well, what's your interpretation of the statute for a judgment entered after 1980?
My interpretation would be either of two ways. One, that entry does not mean entry, and therefore, for these judgments, it's 20 years from the accrual, and the accrual date is not until the lower court loses jurisdiction to revise, and that the full extent of the arrearages are known, which means that the course of time has to run, that the cause of action is not fully ripened. Or one could take the approach that Justice Sykes suggested, that perhaps judgment in 89340, that the legislature did not intend this kind of judgment to be included within the ambit, and then we would go to the interplay between 89304 and 40.
So it sounds to me like it's the same one you're applying here, at least for items that accrued after 1980.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nix. Thank you, Mr. Ramsdale. We're happy to see you, Mr. Nix, again, with or without glasses or comb. And, Mr. Ramsdale, we look forward to your coming again, whether or not you do. That concludes our hearing in 01-1014, State v. Hamilton. We'll take a few moments recess so these students...